Are listening to KBOO Portland.
Your investment in community radio can go on with a planned gift to KBOO. Consider adding KBOO to your will or add KBOO as a beneficiary to your insurance and bank accounts. You can change your mind anytime if your circumstances change. But recognizing KBOO along with your family and friends in your legacy giving is a powerful commitment to media justice. Let us know if you add KBOO to your plans. We'd like to thank you for your considerate future gift. Contact us at 503-231-8032 or email development@kboo.fm to notify us of your plans.
Hello, you're listening to KBOO, KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, keeping Portland safe and in touch. Community radio has never been more important than right now, and you can help support KBOO via the KBOO website at kboo.fm/give. There's also a donate button in the mobile app, or you can text KBOO to 44321. But the best way to support KBOO is by becoming a member at kboo.fm/give. KBOO is a nonprofit, listener-supported community resource for people like you. This is Wider Window Poetry, and I am your host, Teal Ansari, bringing you voices you may not have heard from places you may not have been. But first, a word about the places where you are. KBOO Portland is located on land that includes traditional village sites of the Multnomah, Wasco, Cowlitz, Kathlamet, Clackamas, Bands of Chinook, Tualatin, Kalapuya, Molala, and many other tribes who made their homes along the Columbia and Willamette Rivers, creating communities and summer encampments to harvest and use the plentiful natural resources of the area. Portland is home to almost 70,000 people descended from these tribes and others. As a latecomer to this region, a descendant of slaves and immigrants, I thank the indigenous peoples of the Portland area for their stewardship of this land. I do have a guest this month, but first I'd like to read a poem by Claudia Castro Luna. Claudia Castro Luna is an Academy of American Poets Poet Laureate Fellow 2019. She served as Poet Laureate of Washington State from 2018 to 2021, earlier this year. And before that, she was the first civic poet of the city of Seattle, 2015 to 2018. And I'm going to diverge a minute to say for people living in Portland, we look at Seattle as kind of our big sibling and we snipe at each other as siblings do. But in the last couple of years, a lot of things have happened that remind me how much we have in common with Seattle. So hopefully we can work towards a stronger bond of sibling affection. So, Claudia Castro Luna. Her books include One River, A Thousand Voices and Killing Marias, which was nominated for a pushcart and also shortlisted for the Washington State Book Award in Poetry. And she has a chapbook titled This City. And her most recent collection is nonfiction, There's a Revolution Outside, My Love, Letters from a Crisis, which came out in May of this year. Claudia Castro Luna was born in El Salvador, came to the United States in 1981. She lives in English and Spanish and writes and teaches in Seattle on unceded Duwamish lands where she gardens and keeps chickens with her husband and their three children. And I'd like to read a poem by Claudia Castro Luna, and it's titled Seattle's Poem. Seattle is a house, perched on the comings and goings of water and wind, ripple of fish, feather of crow, early morning ferry yawn. Seattle, I say, and invoke a man and a place, the two inseparable, not proportional, not parallel, but as language is to poem and salt to sea. I watch bridges, bicyclists, boats, summer blankets tendered on public lawns. I watch fiery sunsets tango and sway over jagged peaks and autumn trees bursting gold up and down hilly streets. Nevertheless, before I postcard and gloss and more sunsets and more trees find their way into my lines, I must confess the house's foundation is in places brittle and many rooms dark for windows lack. Plenty have I been on the receiving end of rehearsed indifference, heard enough shallow arguments on who belongs here to wake up scooping ocean water with a spoon. We are all here that need to be. The city is concrete and steel plus the sum of its people. Every day we destroy our house, then race to remake it. Those narrow windows block future's view. Mute voices that need to be heard muffle the sound of the fallen tree limb heavy with ripe plums. Every day we tread over Chief Sialth's legacy, his prophetic words. At night, when the streets will be silent and you think them deserted, they will throng with the returning hosts that once filled them and still love this beautiful land. We are not alone. Save for his people, we are all immigrants here. Waiter, teacher, artist, worker, nurse, we belong. All of us belong. Seattle is a house we all need to afford. That was Seattle's poem by Claudia Castro-Luna. This is KBOO, KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. You're listening to Wider Window Poetry. And my guest this month is Angela Decker. She is an Ashland poet and writer whose work has appeared in Nasty Women Poets, an anthology of subversive verse, Hip Mama, Wisconsin Review, Rattle, and other journals, and her chapbook Splendid Catastrophes, published by Finishing Line Press. She's a morning news host and producer at Jefferson Public Radio, which is an NPR subsidiary, and she lives with her husband, two very tall sons, and an ever-shifting assortment of foster kittens. Welcome, Angela.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Teal, first of all, thank you for having me on this show. And as I mentioned before, Wider Window is now one of my new favorite shows. I listened to several episodes, and I'm so happy that there's a space for poets that's, you know, and not just famous poets, like poets who have things to say, and it's wonderful. So thank you. I'm honored to be here.
Well, thank you, and I'm very glad to have you. So without further ado, I think we'd like to hear some of your poetry.
Okay. And before I start, I just want to say I'd not heard of Claudia Castro-Luna before, and that poem was amazing. So I'm going to look up some of her work, and that was just, it was touching, and I even loved her bio. And I love that part where she says she lives in English and Spanish. It's something I think all poets can lean into, as we tend to live in language. So, I'm going to start with, and the title of this one is pretty self-explanatory, but this happened to me and it makes me laugh, but I'll start with this one. It's called "After Winning an Argument with a Condescending Male Bureaucrat." Turns out I'm the better man, standing tall, belly to belly, language direct and precise, the keen punch of a featherweight boxer. Afterwards, I walk big, fill spaces with nothing but me, front seat, center row, uncross my legs and love the broad expanse of myself. Even my scent is tough, flannel, an afternoon beer, copper sweat. Maybe I'll dig a ditch, fix a car. All day I shimmer in my own virility. At night, I'll raise hell. Whenever I'm feeling stuck, and I don't write frequently, so I often feel stuck, I try to write in a form poem that a local poet here, Amy Miller, had suggested this years ago. It's kind of nice to give you a scaffolding to build your poem on. And when I learned several years ago about the poet Terence Hayes created that style, the golden shovel, and it's basically an acrostic where the end lines of a poem spell out, well, you take the end lines of a famous poem to spell out your own poem. And he started it with Gwendolyn Brooks's pool player, Seven at the Golden Shovel, and also called We Real Cool. And so the first one I wrote, I did the same thing. So this is basically an acrostic of the Gwendolyn Brooks poem. And real quick, I'll just do the Gwendolyn Brooks poem. It's very short. We real cool, we left school. We lurk late, we strike straight, we thin gin, we jazz June, we die soon. So that's Gwendolyn Brooks. And my poem is called Hair, with thanks to Gwendolyn Brooks. We wanted long, straight hair, and we didn't see our own kinky-headed beauty, real beauty, thick, electric, and so damn cool. But the TV, Teen Beat, even our mothers said we didn't have good hair. Hair that bounces and behaves, swings left and right, or flips out of our eyes when we walk to school laughing with friends and pretending like we don't care. But when the blondes blow dry their hair, we lurk long in the locker room, watch each thin strand fly like late summer flax, and hate everything thick and brown. We hate our hair, our friends, our mothers. In the end, we strike at our own heads with hot combs, lie, anything that burns us straight so we can stand in the mirror and pretend we are cute, that we're going places. Girls who play tennis with thin bodies and tight, long ponytails. Girls who sip cold gin. But who are we kidding? Someone puts on a record we love, maybe Stevie Wonder or their mother's jazz. We get to business on our hair, burn it like it's June in hell. Come Monday, we stride the halls and we toss our hair like 1,000 throwing stars. Say, you can die for all we care, but nothing changes. Nothing changes anytime soon. I'm an only child, but I have two cousins and I adore them, and a couple of poems have come out of conversations with them. So this came out of a conversation and a memory with my younger cousin, Demont. On the phone, my cousin lists ways he can die. There's a robbery and I'm the only black guy in the area. My car breaks down and I knock on a door for help. A pickup truck, two white guys. He keeps talking and I'm tired. I've already left the conversation, and in my mind, I'm inside the house we shared as kids. He's finding a TV channel and I'm toasting Pop-Tarts when his coked up father, Roland, comes through the window with a gun and a bag of oranges, says to help him. We put the gun and the bag in the refrigerator while he hides in the backyard. The cops kick in the door just like TV, giant guns, blue eyes everywhere. We lie through our wide lips, and for a long minute, they keep pointing their guns. We keep still, talk polite till they leave. Later, we'll sit on the living room floor with Roland, watch the Partridge Family, while my cousin takes the biggest orange, holds it firm like the whole cold world is in his hands, peels it quiet and slow, keeps the bright skin in one long ribbon. So I am a black woman with mixed race children. And of course I fear for them. That's part of being black in America. And we were having many conversations over the past, you know, just the past year. And I want them to know their worth and their value. And this is all black children, in spite whatever the world throws at them. So this poem kind of came out of that conversation. For Black boys to say they have no country, can't argue much with that. Seems America is a fight you can't win, but don't quit yet. Step over the mud, the want, and grab. Keep on stepping, son. With your made in America walk, that long-legged, heavy stride. Move toward whatever the hell you want. Eyes up, teeth together. Let them see you coming strong and steady like there's nothing can stop you. You've got the light in you. You've got the fire, the fury, the wonder. You're a whole damn nation. I wrote this after I had watched several TV news stations, and this wasn't even recent. It wasn't during the protest for racial justice. This, well, it was a protest for racial justice, but it wasn't after George Floyd. This is way back when in LA, a couple kids were protesting a police shooting, and the TV news focused primarily on the fact that this group of Black kids burned this little flag, right? And they're weeping. One of their friends had been killed, and the cameras are showing these young boys crying. And yeah, they're protesting, and they light a flag. And so that was the news story. It was just flag burning in LA. And this is also a form, it's a pantoum. So there's some repetition. Another protest in the news. It's only news because they burn a flag. Really, only news because they're Black and just two Black, thick-lipped boys whose pants kind of sag. It's only news because they burn a flag. No mention of the grief, the fury. Black, thick-lipped boys whose pants kind of sag. In the smoke, they're all raised fists and glory. No mention of the grief, the fury, just a hot TV tag. In the smoke, they're all raised fists and glory. Flames glitter the edges of a limp little flag. Just a hot TV tag. Another protest in the news. Flames glitter the edges of a limp little flag. Really only news because they're Black and just too. And again, I get a lot of my, I work in a news station, so I get a lot of my poems from news. And I do remember in 2018 when Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was elected, and shortly after, Cornell University did a display of kind of women politicians' clothing. And one, they had, you know, Ruth Bader Ginsburg's lace collars and Hillary Clinton's white pantsuit. And the photo that I saw was AOC's shoes that she wore. She went door to door campaigning in New York, and they were so torn up, and they had holes in the, you remember, there were holes in the bottom. They were just jacked up, and she was so proud. And so I thought, wow, those shoes say it all. So anyway, this is, here's, it's called Respect to the Hustle, praise poem for Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and her shoes. We thought we were done, all broken, brown or woman, pride sagging low, but there you come, marching door to door to door, talking to us like we've got the muscle. Respect to you, lady. To the hustle, rainwater seeping through the holes in your flat, hard shoes. Respect to the fight in your voice, to the tough girl bones of your feet and the way they keep running, not from the left, as you say, but from the bottom, head up, hell-bent for leather.
Well, that is a lovely and very fitting tribute to an extraordinary person. I do want to say, though, you know, they don't really normally do displays of men's politicians' clothing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I was like, I remember when I saw it, my first thought was I rolled my eyes and I was just like, what the hell? You know, are we going to ever see, you know, George Bush's boots or something? No, because nobody cares, but that is part of it. And yet I was still, I still read the article. I went, ooh, look at those shoes. And they do say a lot. And I didn't realize when I was putting these, I put some poems in order, and I didn't realize that I have a second shoe poem. So in keeping with a shoe theme, this is another one. This came out of a conversation I had with my cousin Riri many years ago when we were shopping. And I know everybody has Birkenstocks, but I had just been reading, was it The Warmth of Other Suns by Isabel Wilkerson. She'd recently wrote Cast. And so The Warmth of Other Suns is about the great migration of Blacks out of the Jim Crow South. And some of them went to the Midwest, some North, and to California. It's an amazing book, and I always, always highly recommend it. But this came out of this conversation in a mall with my cousin, and also just that book was in the back of my head. My cousin calls them Jesus sandals, says only white folks wear them. We're in a mall, and she's shaking her head at the big display of open, flat shoes. She jokes it's because so many white folks love Jesus, and the shoes make them feel good. Clunky cork soles are no problem because they never need to run fast or far. We like our sturdy kicks, Timberland boots, Air Jordans, shoes built to move easy when chased out of nice neighborhoods, the good schools, home. As for Jesus, we want to love him too. Once thousands of Negroes fled the South like mice from a burning tree, chasing northbound buses, jumping trains, walking wicked roads, some with nothing but grief and solid shoes. Poor white Jesus must have heard their rising prayers, maybe planned to guide that fast-paced horde. But in his silly sandals, he had to walk slow, tread careful, never did catch up. I'm switching. Do you ever do that when you're in the middle of a reading? Go, I don't want to read that one. So this one, after Chadwick Boseman died, which was a huge shock, right? Or Black Panther, and so young and magnificent. And I remember seeing Black Panther, and now he's in other films as well that have come out posthumously, but anyway.
He kept it a secret from almost everyone. Yeah, very few people, even in the film industry, knew that he was ill.
Which makes it even more poignant that, you know, he was going through so much. So anyway, I wrote a poem for Chadwick Boseman. And it starts with an epigraph by Nikki Giovanni. I wanna say, just gotta say something about those beautiful, beautiful, beautiful out of sight Black men. Nikki Giovanni. God damn it, feels like every day there's one more thing to break us. Police shoot another name for us to shout. News and leaders blame the dead. Even this virus wants us the most. Yet we're still stepping fists up. Still, I wept the night our superhero died. That brown-skinned Marvel, that Black Panther, I wept for us all. The loss of another beautiful, out-of-sight man. For people who have no Superman, no one faster than all the ugly folks let fly at us. I wept for that day when the theater was filled with Black children cheering for a savior who looks like them. The misty-eyed parents who started a standing ovation before the movie even ended. And mostly for the man holding his daughter's hand as we all left, his short afro glowing copper in the sun, looking like a movie hero too. His smile large and proud. And I heard him say to her, "That makes you feel like it's gonna be okay, don't it?" Around January, I was just sort of feeling, I was not sort of, I was feeling pretty frustrated. There'd been a lot, just a lot going on in the world, in our country, in our community of Ashland. A man had shot a young Black man in a hotel parking lot for playing his music too loud. And many people, some of whom I remember were at at the protests for George Floyd with, you know, with their Black Lives Matter signs and their little t-shirts and stuff, started making excuses for the white man who shot him with, you know, well, his music was loud and just ridiculous, crazy things. And everybody just seemed to slip right back into their old racist habits. And so this kind of came out of that. And again, this was January, sharing my resolutions with white folks. I will not protest nonviolently. I will not join your chants and prayers, your candlelight vigils, your lie-ins, your sit-ins, your goddamn sing-ins. Singing for justice, really? No nice poems. I will say nigger just to hear you gasp, see you lick your lips with the longing to say it too. When another black man, woman, or child is murdered, and you, wet-eyed, say, I'm sorry this is happening to you, I might slap you. You've wasted our time, our dignity, our children. So many children. Don't wring your hands for me. Better you reach out, hand me those matches, help me burn it all down. Changed my little tune here a little bit. That being said, I also, I'm gonna shift tone a little bit here because I do work at I work early in the morning. I realized a couple weeks ago, really, that I never really paid attention. I walk out my door around 4:15 in the morning to go to work, and I get in my car and I get to work and I open the door, I do what I have to do, but I don't really enjoy my surroundings. And I live in this beautiful part of Southern Oregon, just gorgeous. And it always smells like pine, and there's beautiful greenery and scenery. Well, not right now because everything's dried up, but this was on a much, much lighter note, just a poem I wrote after talking to one of my coworkers who does pay attention to all the things I don't pay attention to. Morning broadcast. Most every stranger knows his voice, though in a crowd, who would notice the white-haired radio host, his quick walk and colorful socks? At the microphone, his questions are smart, his voice calm, commuters slow their drives. Others sip coffee, lean toward their radios. When he reads the weather, he speaks his own early morning walk along train tracks. The cartwheels of fading stars or the glow of pale light between clouds. He'll tell the taste of air rich with frost or the electric spice before a rain. None of it necessary, none of it news, but it's good to have a reminder the world may not always be such a wreck. And we're maybe not so wretched. Anything wrong could be righted. We can step outside in the early hours. We can look up. And I'm going to, I think I've got two more. And this is one more that a conversation with my cousin. All the music. Cousin Riri and I are old enough to be grandmas, and we're listening to music like teenagers again. Lisa Lisa and Cult Jam, Billy Ocean, Macy Gray's Sexomatic Venus Freak on repeat. Music, music all day long. I'm in my headphones at work. She's dancing at her kitchen sink. We're boogieing to our beds. Not sure when it all came back. Maybe with the world back bent and heavy with sorrow, us folks marching, crying for our brothers, our children, hands clapping, heels slapping. There's music in grief and music in hope. It's why grandmas always be singing. They know about hard days, how it feels like the world will break you, but the sun shines even in rough neighborhoods. Songs keep on coming, and our feet, our bony feet, keep on moving. And I've got, I write a lot about my family, I realize. And I don't have a big family, or, you know, we're a pretty small group. And I tend to end with this one because my mom likes it a lot. and she just visited me after, I think, 18 months of not seeing each other, and the only child. So we were like, ah, so great to see you. Swing. After school, my beautiful mother would wait for me by the swings. She'd chat with the other moms, flirt with the dads, lean against a tree in snug jeans, gold stilettos. When I came out of class, raced to her light, she'd step away from the gossip and the smiling men to push me on the swings. Even in those crazy shoes, she'd push strong, tell me to pump my legs. When I die, I want death to come to me like my mother. A wide smile and high, high heels, hands pressed to my back, firmly pushing me to the sun. I'm gonna stop there.
Well, your family may be small, but they are mighty.
Thanks. I have a bunch of kid poems, and my kids have asked me to stop writing about them. I'm just like, you've got four poems with us naked.
So apparently I shouldn't ask you to read any of those poems. Yeah.
I will. They can't hear me.
Just as long as they don't listen to the episode.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. But yeah, this past few years, they have repeatedly asked me, and during readings, I used to always break out, one poem from when they were little. But now my youngest is 16, and my oldest is leaving for college on Monday. So, it's a big shift. I think the next thing that's been kind of stirring around has been that watching your kids sort of leave the nest. It's a big one.
You're listening to KBOO, KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. This is Wider Window Poetry, and my guest this month is Angela Decker, who just read us some amazing poetry. I was very, very glad to hear it. So I want to ask you, because a couple of your poems, you mentioned the media and how they present things, and how, you know, we had a very gendered presentation around female politicians centered on their clothing. And also you read a poem about how there was media coverage of a protest in LA, which was a protest of a police shooting, and was completely focused on the fact that the protesters burned a small flag and completely overlooked their actual reason for protesting and the fact that a child had been shot by the police. And you work for Jefferson Public Radio, which is part of NPR, as a news host. So how do you, in your day-to-day work, negotiate, you know, the representation in the media and how it shapes people's perceptions of events?
You know, that's something that I've been thinking about, well, from probably the moment I started working there. And first, I will say that NPR, especially over the past 5 or 6 years, has been really good about doing the opposite of what mainstream television media does. And JPR also, even when I have a lot of freedom in how I present the local news. So I have different areas that I pull that news from, but we have some, you know, we have some standards that I can go by. So in public radio, there is no if it bleeds, it leads. We won't do that. It's regional news that is of some importance to people. We won't go with the most startling or the bloody or, you know, the most lurid story. So in terms of how we present the news, I think that's just a given that we're not going to do that. And I think public radio overall has been especially sensitive to that. And again, I think I started at JPR back in 2015. So I've seen I've had the chance to see just the sensitivity with which they'll present something versus, you know, a Fox News or something like that. And then in my day-to-day, to a degree, in my day-to-day work and hearing the news, that's a little bit harder. So I have my bit of freedom where I'm not going to focus on, if I have a news story and that story even is focusing on some, there's one part that is unimportant, like a little flag versus the bigger story, I can just, you know, I don't even know if I'm allowed to say this, I can just leave that part out if it's just not germane to the story. And I often do, just for time's sake, I will take out anything that's not germane because I only have two minutes and 40 seconds to get out as much news as I can. And personally, there, I will say, during George Floyd's murder, even NPR, they were playing some of the audio of him begging for his life. They were playing it, and I could not take it. I admitted this in one of our, we did this online fund drive where everybody who worked at JPR would record a brief little snippet of, you know, why you should support the radio station. And I had originally written something about, oh, well, you know, we're a community and support us because we're your news source. And I couldn't say any of it. I was just, you know, I was in between stories in that studio crying, literally crying. And I am not emotional. And I finally just said, hey, this has been a terrible year. And these George Floyd stories hit me personally. And all of the other countless murders by police hit me personally. And I simultaneously just said how I feel. And I think I kind of came out as Black because on the radio, nobody knows anything. And it was pretty liberating. I got a couple emails and even somebody approached me at the store just saying, hey, we heard you and thank you. And wow, we're going to approach this differently. We're going to try to take a hard look at ourselves. And again, I'm not sure how much any of this has lasted because there hasn't been a lot of, you know, tangible changes, but yeah, it did feel good to just honestly say, this is hard and it's painful and it's personal. So I don't know if that answered your question.
Well, it does to some degree. I mean, obviously not to get into sort of a blow by blow, but you do have a public platform and you're able to use it to make a difference, or at least all we all so hope.
We all do hope. And like I said, I have a lot of freedom at JPR and, you know, within the parameters of delivering the news. And so I can make those choices in terms of how something is going to be presented and whether or not it's going to be, you know, just sensitive to the world at large. And also, mm-hmm. as a producer, I can help select guests for our talk show. And our talk show host is amazing. He's the one I wrote the little poem about. He's very good at discussing issues and bringing the most honest responses from people without diving into anything lurid or, you know, just to make points.
So I'd like you to talk a little bit about, you know, during COVID, obviously there was a lot of physical isolation, and my feeling is that made mass media very important, and especially community mass media, which, you know, television stations, local newspapers, local websites, and local radio stations, there's been a lot of erosion of that over the last few decades. And I think and hope that people, you know, in this last year and a half have maybe felt an increased importance to local news. Could you talk a little bit about how your station worked during COVID getting out information, helping spread the word about vaccinations, any of that sort of thing?
Yeah, and first of all, I think you're right. I think during COVID, people were relying more on public radio, on the media in general, but I think more on regional public radio. And also our local newspaper has recently, it's basically been folded into a more regional paper. So we won't be getting that local newspaper every day, and it will just be online. And even that regional newspaper is going to go to, I think, 4 or 5 days a week. So there's been definitely an erosion of just of local and regional information. And as I said, we have these pledge drives, and even though we didn't have that group people coming in and volunteers coming in and calling and doing all the extra things, we still did our online virtual pledge drive. And we were surprised that at the amount of support that we got, because we thought, oh, this is going to be a really rough year, but people were listening. And I feel like, and I might have just lost the train of your question, but I do feel like that became even more important. And I think that responsibility was not unrecognized. And in terms of getting the news, we've got amazing reporters, and nothing really changed. They didn't come into the office, but they were working from home, and they were out there, and they were talking to people, and again, largely over the phone, but they were getting information, and they were getting it quickly. And with the coronavirus, everybody took precautions. There were a few times where we would get that call that we'd been exposed to COVID, and I think one person even had tested positive, I'm not sure, but we did it, we managed to do it all. And I'm really proud. I'm proud to be a part of that. I'm proud to be a part of this organization where I was watching our reporters and our news director just scrambling. And as far as getting out the word for vaccines, I think they did a great job. They did as best as they absolutely could. And our talk show end, we tried to get as many guests on to talk so that people would know where the access was. And all this was going on right, during the Alameda fires. And then we were also trying to scramble to get people the help they needed who were impacted by the fires. And there were so many. And there still are. There are people that still don't have housing, and there are clusters of people that have not been vaccinated, and we're still trying to get all of that information out as fast as possible. So it's just been, it's been impressive. And I don't mean to sound like a shill for the radio station, but I'm pretty proud of the work that they've all been doing.
This is Wider Window Poetry on KBOO, KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. My guest is Angela Decker, who's joining us from Ashland and talking about the great work that Jefferson Public Radio's been doing in the community, especially during this time. I want to ask if your work group, your team, has experienced much in the way of burnout. And there's been so much to do and so many hard things to cover in the last couple of years.
Yeah, I can say I don't want to speak for them personally, but I can't imagine they haven't. I know people are exhausted, and I will say for me, I keep looking for that. There was this little part of me when people, and I didn't really want this because we need our jobs, but both my husband, who works for the county, and I our work lives didn't really change, but our kids were suddenly working, doing their schoolwork from home. And we were exhausted probably like 15 months ago. And my coworkers, I think especially the reporters, until recently, they really haven't been able to take any breaks. They were just going. And most of the on-air hosts, of course, weren't able to take any breaks. And I'm surprised that there hasn't been a greater exodus just across the board in workspaces. I know a lot of people have been just quitting their jobs, and not necessarily at JPR, but just in general, people have been quitting their jobs more often. That was a recent news story. And I think part of that is coming from that burnout. And I think at JPR, because we're such a small crew, people are given the opportunity to take those breaks, but even taking a few vacation days usually requires several people to help cover that, and they just haven't done it as much. And while we haven't had a conversation about burnout, I would be hard pressed to think they weren't they weren't exhausted. And so, but they're still trucking, they're still going on.
So Southern Oregon has a remarkably vibrant poetry scene. I want to shout out to the Rogue Valley poets and also the Applegate poets. Have you all been doing in this last couple of years? How's poetry surviving?
You know what? I think, and you're right, it's a vibrant poetry community. I moved here 16 years ago, and I remember after a couple of months, my second son had just been born, so I didn't do anything for a while. But after a while, I thought, oh, I wonder if there's any poetry here. And then suddenly, oh my gosh, there's a boatload of poetry here. And everybody is so supportive. And I belong to a poetry group. And as I mentioned, we kept meeting. We tried a couple Zoom meetings. And then because Southern Oregon isn't super cold, we would just sort of bundle up and meet outside in various backyards just so that we could keep our poetry group going and keep sharing poems and keep supporting one another. And so during all of this, I've watched other people in other poetry groups do the same thing. They find, poetry will find a way, and they will get together and they will, you know, either via Zoom or socially distance, or I even heard of one group that just emailed their poems and they would just email each other. And the whole thing was done over email. And it works, because I think you need this. This is such a bizarre time. I think you need the community that poetry offers. And I've noticed just recently a lot of collections coming out from local writers here about the fires. And I think it took a while, of course, for us to process that. And we're processing the fire and COVID and processing lost people, lost loved ones to COVID. As we're processing all of that, poetry is nourishment. Poetry is something that we really need. So I'm pretty impressed with the Rogue Valley poetry folks.
Okay, I think I'd like for you to read a couple more poems if you would. And then I have a completely random question that I'm going to ask you.
Okay, a completely random question. I'm going to read some older poems. Here. This one is very old and but my kids are in it, but they're not naked. So, right. This is from when they were both very young. And if I get weepy, it's because my son, my 18-year-old, is in the other room packing to leave for college. So, boys in the bed. Some nights our sons creep into our bed like cats, friendly spirits. Sleep is precious, and I groan at the intrusion, their hot feet, sharp elbows, ankles all poking at once. But then the crowded bed grows lush with the softness of their skin, and night is thick with sleep and the sweet smell of babies. Our bodies are cupped into one another, and it's a familiar feeling, a kind of reverse pregnancy with them on the outside now. Once again, we're one world, one body, one steady heartbeat. Just before dawn, I wake to watch them sleep. My oldest is serious even now, dark lashes resting on his cheeks, his brother snoring gently, mouth already a crooked grin. I cannot look at them hard enough, cannot feel this long enough. A queen-sized bed packed with family, these great wizards in small bodies, arms outstretched above their heads, drawing deep swells of breath and pulling the morning toward us. And then I've got, I feel bad. I was going to read this one about my husband, but I didn't want to end with it because he's a wonderful, wonderful man. And this was the one time I wrote a poem where he annoyed me because he got the flu. And you know how men are? And so I'm going to read it, but then I'm going to finish with one that is not, like, you know, complaining about my sweet, sweet husband.
Okay.
Okay. It's short. Tough guy. My husband gets the flu and I lose all respect for him. He shuffles and sniffs and whines for aspirin, a thermometer, and please, honey, some more tea, this time with lemon. I should appreciate his asking, his willingness to admit frailty, allow for his weakened state. But I'm wicked, and for a brief, shameful moment, I want Shaft or John Wayne or any other cold-blooded badass who never gets sick, never needs nobody, and never, ever says please. And then I'll finish up with this one. Mistakes. At bedtime, my sons ask me about mistakes, how to fix them, when to hide them. I say mistakes are simply lessons, tiny tests we've all endured. I tuck in their Star Wars blankets, hand one a stuffed bunny, the other a Harry Potter book, and they suddenly lose interest in their own errors, the life lesson at hand. They want to know my mistakes, all of them. But it's already 8 o'clock, and I can't talk of times I should have studied, but instead kissed Andrew Flores in his aunt's basement. The lies I told my parents, missteps too big for their ears. I shrug and say simply, I've made a lot. And they lean in like raptors, ask, how many? How many exactly? 10, 100, 1,000? When I mumble, oh, something like that, their mouths drop wide and their eyes go bright as they imagine a sort of gallery of their mother's mistakes, rows and rows of brightly colored disasters, splendid catastrophes stretching across a lifetime.
All right, here's the random question. If you could observe one historical event, one event from the past, you don't get to change it, just to see it, what would you choose and why?
Oh my gosh. Just one?
Just one. Well, it could be like a long event.
Just to see it. Just, but I can't. Right.
You don't get to change it. We're not doing time travel paradoxes here.
Okay. Okay. Wow. You know, if I thought about this, I could give you this really deep and amazing answer, but I know we're on the clock. And the first thing that popped in my mind is, I think I would have loved to have, seen that moment during the civil rights movement when so many people, when they were marching across the Edmund Pettus Bridge, and so many people were united in that call for civil rights. And yes, time paradox, time travel, I could warn people that there was going to be, you know, that they would be hurt and there would be death and there would be fear. But at the same time, I think it's a reminder of just the power we all have as if when we come together, and just the force and the beauty of a community all working towards the same cause. And that would, I think that just would have been the, like, just an amazing, and there are people alive who have, you know, I've talked to a woman who lives here who was part of that. And I'm constantly just in awe that she was part of something so amazing and so historical. And I think so many things have happened since with just various communities, and even during the past year, that we can look back on and say, wow, that is some amazing community organization and movement. But I think I would have liked to have seen that.
Well, thank you for that answer. And I will share that I recently saw a photo, obviously a drone photo, of a mass of people marching across one of the bridges in Portland that was taken last summer. I don't know the exact date, but during the protests that we had here after the murder of George Floyd. And looking at that photo was enough to bring me to tears, because, you know, we were there, we lived through this.
Yeah. And we came together for that moment.
Yes, we did. You've been listening to Wider Window Poetry on KBOO, KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. My guest has been Angela Decker. Angela, thank you so much for joining us.
Teal, this has been absolute pleasure for me. Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you for doing Wider Window.
And to all my listeners out there, please stay safe. Keep on keeping on, and we'll talk to you again next month. Thank you and goodbye.
KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
Did you know that KBOO podcasts all our news and talk shows?
You can find the podcast on KBOO's website, kboo.fm, on Google Play, iTunes, and Stitcher.
Just search for your favorite show and hit subscribe to get all the latest episodes downloaded to your favorite device.
Or search for KBOO on iTunes, Google Play to get all the KBOO podcasts.